It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I am Tony Vernetti from Federal Employee Defense Services, and we have an exciting show for you today. John Adler, the president of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, or FLEOA, is in studio with me, and we are going to be discussing what's going on in the world of federal law enforcement. John, we appreciate you spending some time with us today. Good morning and welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Tony. Always great to be here.
Just a reminder that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information on GEICO, go to geico.com. If you'd like to join our discussion today, you can call in. Our toll-free number is 1-877-936-9333. Now, John, I know we have a host of topics you want to get into today, but to start, I always like to have you just take a few minutes, tell our listeners about the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, you know, particularly those who may be new to federal law enforcement.
Yeah, FLEOA is the largest nonprofit, nonpartisan professional association exclusively representing federal law enforcement officers and members of our community. Our members come from over 65 different federal agencies. Both active and retired members included in the overall membership. We provide legal counsel to our members 24/7, and we pride ourselves as serving as the federal voice or the voice for federal law enforcement in Washington, D.C.
And how could somebody get some more information on your organization if they wanted to look into it and join?
The best way to do that, other than being bombarded by my sound bites, is go to the website, www.fleoa, the acronym, FLEOA.org.
Okay. Well, let's jump into it. I want to talk about what's going on at DHS and the suspension of what's called administratively uncontrollable overtime, or AUO. And just to back up a little bit, about a year ago, OSC, Office of Special Counsel, came out with a report or a decision, essentially, that DHS was violating the overtime laws and the rules in the way that they were implementing their AUO out in the field. And for those of you who don't know, AUO is when you're in the law enforcement job, you know, your schedule is not always 9 to 5. Okay. You know, the bad guys don't fit that in within 9 to 5. So there's times when you're gonna be required to respond, to come out, to come back to work and things like that. And AUO is a way similar to the LEAP for the 1811s in a way to compensate them for that work, as opposed to paying them overtime, which would actually have to be scheduled. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the recent decision at DHS and why FLEOA is concerned about it?
Yeah, and I think just to add on to what the background on this, Tony, you know, what Carolyn Lerner came out with was really the result of whistleblower testimony and statements that alleged that there were individuals within the department, specifically within CBP and or Border Patrol, that were receiving AUO payment and they weren't earning or deserving it. So what happened is, you know, in the spin factor of this situation, obviously it reaches the ears of Congress and they're concerned, and ultimately hearings are scheduled and held. And right before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee held a hearing on this as relates to Border Patrol, the acting ICE director issued a memo indicating that AUO was immediately being suspended for headquarter personnel and training personnel within ICE, but for all components within DHS that are headquartered and or training.
So just a complete cut across the board, not a specific analysis of position by position?
Well, yes. However, the messaging out indicated that there was extensive legal analysis done. I disagree. As well as an ongoing review and examination of all relevant factors. The concern is the timing of this, as well as the fact that this ultimately equates to a 25% pay cut. Now, think about it for all of you listeners living in D.C. Imagine that you woke up the next morning, you know, you had your Cheerios, and you find out 25% of your pay is being suspended, and you did nothing wrong.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point. What I like to point out is, you know, you go back, we had something similar happen back in the 90s, which is how we ended up with LEAP, Law Enforcement Availability Pay Act, is that Congress found out that agencies were essentially violating FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, by requiring law enforcement personnel to work certain hours above beyond the 40-hour work week, and there were class actions filed. And in result, you know, to the response to the class actions is we came up with these concepts, or AUO was always there, but we came up with concepts to more routinely implement it, and as well as LEAP for the 1811s. My concern for the agency, you know, if you go back to, you know, those old ways, you know, and I've got information that tells me they're cutting out in the field as well across the board. I mean, there hasn't been the same proclamation or declaration, but it's happening. I get calls all the time, you know, my capacity, you know, at Feds, that they're going to make themselves vulnerable to lawsuits again, the class action lawsuits that they're going to, you know, it's just going to inevitably, you know, they're going to end up violating the overtime laws again.
Yeah, I think the approach was entirely wrong and overzealous, if not mean-spirited, to the extent that you could basically put someone under economic duress who's living in D.C. The point is, the reaction to Ms. Lerner's report should be, let's take a real deep dive into not just the scope of the work, but the management oversight and accountability for it. No one's questioning that the uncontrollable, unanticipated, unexpected work is there. Tony, as you put it, you know, criminals don't work. They're not 9 to 5, right? They're sporadic. And if we're not ready, and what is D.C., by the way? D.C. is, in effect, the command post for the entire country. So if you don't have people responding to everything going on in every city and town in our country, you have no command post, you have no organization. Ultimately, what you will have is sort of a free-for-all, the wild, wild west. The important thing here is the proper response to her report was, let's get into the oversight, not let's buckle to congressional whim and simply suspend the pay of hardworking people. We disagree with the legal interpretation that was put forth by the department regarding AUL eligibility. FLIOA has a position statement prepared by General Counsel Larry Berger that challenges what was put forth allegedly in their extensive research and is making the argument and the position that, in fact, these individuals are eligible. And again, the focus and emphasis should be on the oversight and accountability, not simply automatically eliminating 25% of someone's pay.
And John, can you tell us a little bit more about what FLIOA is doing in response to some of your efforts in the executive branch?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we got involved sort of unexpectedly, a lot of words beginning with UN, and we're somewhat blindsided by the memo that went out to all ICE employees. Unfortunately, we didn't have any open lines available to us, so we issued a press release, which garnered up a lot of news media attention and ultimately caught the attention of the folks over in Homeland as well. And we've since been engaged and been hosting a series of very productive conversations in regarding to what options are available and how to fix this issue. I mean, it's been made clear to me it's an absolute priority by the department. We're going to continue meeting with the executives there in a hopes that I can convince them to rescind this decision pending further analysis and research. And, you know, also we're going to be working with the members in Congress, the House Homeland Security and the Senate Homeland Security Committees, to explain to them the proper context for what's going on so they better understand it and they're not simply getting a slanted or one-sided version of what's transpired.
You know, it's funny, in OSC's report, Ms. Lerner's report, you know, they note that this this activity, the way it's been working, has been going on for years, decades, right? Decades. So it's in the custom, it's in the culture, and then they, you know, just come out and almost unilaterally, you know, cut it off at its knees. You know, in the report, it talked about consulting with the law enforcement stakeholders and the unions. But you guys said you were blindsided. They didn't reach out to FLEO at all. Did they consult with the union?
My understanding is they did have some communication with the union. Obviously, it wasn't satisfactory, but we had absolutely zero communication with FLEOA. And again, Tony, you know, we're not presumptuous enough to think that we're going to tell any agency head how to run their agency. But something as significant as this, even drawing upon, I'd make available our attorneys who I would put up as having the best expertise in this field compared to any attorney in the country. I mean, come on, don't we owe it to the men and women in D.C. and in training to at least do a thorough review, examination, and assessment? You know, again, the timing of it was suspect, the manner in which it was done is suspect, and the consequences are severe.
Well, another practical impact, you know, real quick is, you know, if this is how it's going to be, no one's going to take these positions in headquarters, and you need qualified people in these positions. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm here with John Adler from FLEOA. We'll continue our discussion after this break and a word from our sponsor.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how Geico actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, Geico saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Tony Vernetti, and I'm talking with John Adler from FLEOA, and we were talking about issues affecting the federal law enforcement community. When we took our break, we were talking about the AUO situation that's going on over at DHS. We're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about marijuana. You know, as I was watching the Super Bowl, I was reminded, you know, that both Colorado and Washington State legalized, you know, marijuana. So, you know, we're seeing that a lot in the press these days, you know, billboards, advertisement. And I know the administrator over at DEA came out and had some, you know, words to say, you know, about marijuana and effects of marijuana, you know, in her capacity as administrator and as a citizen. And I know the MPP, which is the Marijuana Policy Project, had some harsh words about that and asked the president to have her resign.
Yeah, the pothead fan club or whatever they are issued a petition calling for the termination of Michelle Leonhardt, who, by the way, is probably, you know, one of our top law enforcement leaders in the country, and I put her up against any law enforcement leader, both past and present. But what do I really feel? So anyhow, they just issued this petition, and the reason they issued it was they're alleging that the administrator was insubordinate to the president, President Obama, who had recently expressed a view regarding, or comparative review or comment regarding, alcohol versus marijuana and which one is worse, is one worse than the other. And it is the administrator's informed view, being a career law enforcement officer, both local and federal, and without a doubt an expert in the area of illicit drugs, that in fact it is untrue, and it is a faulty comparison to say that marijuana is no more harmful than alcohol, when in fact it is clearly a gateway drug, as we like to call it, meaning that it'll sort of lead a user to a need, a physiological need for a greater fix or a greater or stronger drug to satisfy their need. But that aside, the point being is this. You expect leaders to express views, and sometimes leaders may or may not agree with the president, But you see, there's this little First Amendment thing that applies to all of us, not just those who smoke weed. So I think the whole point of the petition is ridiculous, and I questioned their state of mind when they issued it. And, you know, we stand 101% behind Administrator Leonhardt. She's a fantastic leader. She's dedicated. She's entitled to her views. We support her views. And certainly anyone issuing a petition calling for her resignation, you know, that might fly in a fascist or a dictator type of country. It doesn't fly in the United States of America.
Yeah, and if I can just echo your comments about Administrator Leonhardt, because I certainly know of her, my days, you know, my old law firm, and when I worked at ATF, she is the real deal. Okay, you know, not a political appointee. You know, she grew up in law enforcement. You know, so I'd be respecting her views before a lot of folks. But to me, it's sometimes part of a larger issue that they're going to have to deal with and tackle, you know, because even though a lot of these jurisdictions, you know, the two have legalized marijuana, it's still a violation of federal law.
Right.
It's her responsibility to enforce those laws. It's the president's responsibility as a chief executive to support her enforcing those laws. You know, so it's puzzling to me to see how MPP thinks that she's coming out and being insubordinate to the president in her comments.
Right. How dare she follow legal statutes? You know, it's par for the course. There's also, you know, and Tony, the argument goes towards the economic factor as well, that with the whole legalization of marijuana, you know, it'll bring revenue in. And as I indicated in a written response to the petition they issued, you know, FLEO and federal law enforcement do not subscribe to smoke a doobie and balance the budget formula of economics. It's, you know, I'd rather cut back in foreign aid first.
Good stuff. Let's shift gears here and talk about over at HUD and with the OIG agents over there, when we had our recent shutdowns and furlough periods, all the stuff that disrupted the lives of federal employees in 2013. Hopefully we won't have the same in 14. But I know they came and they took some of their equipment, their equipment away, their guns.
That's an understatement, Tony. And may the sequester rest in its peace wherever it may be right now, and the shutdowns associated with it. Yeah, and we had a bad situation. Unfortunately, you know, the HUD leadership decided a day before the shutdown was implemented that all of their law enforcement agents, their special agents, were directed to turn in their weapons, turn in their guns. And the day after the shutdown, they issued further quote-unquote guidance that the agents were prohibited from not only carrying a government-issued weapon, but from using their government-issued credentials to carry a personally owned weapon if they in fact owned one. And they were advised to go seek a state permit if they wanted to carry a weapon. Now, here's the thing. Aside from the fact that I think they and the only other agency I'm aware of is Department of Interior, OIG, but there was absolutely no legal basis for what they did, number one. But even trumping the legal interpretation or aspect is the fact of agent safety, which can't be compromised. HUD deals in a lot of serious enforcement type of cases and investigations. They come into contact and investigate and apprehend some very dangerous people. So to take the guns away from the agents unnecessarily and expose them to danger and risk of bumping into someone. And by the way, this did happen. One of the agents I personally know did have an encounter, if you will, with someone that agent had previously arrested. And that, it boggles the mind. Unfortunately, the leadership wasn't willing to entertain us. We had some legal research done to help them with their decision. And instead, they stuck to their guns. Bad pun intended, and took the guns away from the men and women. And here's the thing, you know, Tony, when there's a shutdown, you don't stop being a federal law enforcement officer. Unfortunately, you're on leave without pay for, you know, a protracted period of time, but you're still a law enforcement officer. You're still sworn and you're still employed. So therefore, there is no reason why they couldn't simply issue a memo saying you will carry your weapon for the duration of the shutdown for personal protection only.
Well, I mean, they have the right under LEOSA as well, you know, to do that. And, you know, personal safety was one of the major reasons. Two questions on this. One, I mean, was there ever a consideration just to declare them essential and keep them at work, You know, one. And then two, what was the rationale? Why did they feel this was necessary?
The first question, I don't think there was due consideration to that, given the fact that I think the majority of the special agents were furloughed. You know, those few who may have gotten a written letter from the United States Attorney's Office requesting their sustained participation in critical grand jury investigations might have had an exemption, and you can count those on one hand, you know, missing fingers. But I don't think the proper consideration was done, because obviously other inspector general agencies did properly deem their law enforcement personnel and assets essential. And the second part of your question, what's their reasoning? Well, from what was written in the memo, they said during a shutdown, since you're not engaging in authorized government and or law enforcement action, you have to turn in all your government assets. And if you do anything, you're outside the scope of your employment. So basically, surrender your life and surrender your experiences, surrender your risk, and you're on your own. And hopefully this too shall pass, and when it does, we'll give you your gun back. But in the meantime, we also issued a memo to all the criminals out there. You are not to bother any HUD agents because we took their guns away. I mean, this is how preposterous this is.
Well, it's funny, and we were talking about the overtime issue, before and the money situation. Some of this comes from that worry that if they leave them, if they let them keep continue to have their guns, you know, as you and I know, just because you're furloughed, you don't stop being a law enforcement officer. The criminal justice system doesn't stop, doesn't cease to exist. If there's something that needs to be done, you're going to do it, mostly. You know, and the worry, you know, the worry for the agency is A, you know, I don't think it's a worry about liability. I think it's just trying to protect themselves. But, you know, I think they're getting advice from general counsel's office that this can make them vulnerable for claims to be reimbursed for pay for that period. Because other agencies, non-law enforcement agencies, the voicemails that were left, the automatic response to the emails you would send them were very clear that they are not in the office, they will not be in the office, just kind of over the top stuff to make it, you know, very clear, because they weren't authorized, they weren't allowed to do any work because they didn't want the claims for, you know, for but the pay.
But Tony, didn't you get the beautiful irony of what you just said, that they were protecting themselves, and the protection of their administrative backside trumped the protection of law enforcement safety? Isn't that just beautiful?
You know, it's it's just, you know, again, part of, you know, an unfortunate year, you know, for federal employees, you know, all together. You talk about the furloughs, the sequestration, you know, and just all the sort of negative energy out there. I hope it's going to be a better year in 2014. I'd like to stop here and take our second break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with John Adler, the president of FLIOA. You're talking to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Deborah Roth, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Our firm specializes in helping federal employees with legal issues concerning their jobs or benefits. For two decades, we have been representing federal employees in adverse action cases, employment discrimination complaints, inspector general and internal affairs investigations, security clearance issues, and other federal employment disputes. If you have a legal concern, don't wait. Call Shaw, Bransford & Roth at 202 202- 463-8400 or visit our website at shawbransford.com.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Tony Vernetti, and we're talking with John Adler from the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, and we're discussing a lot of the goings-ons in federal law enforcement. The first half of the show, we were talking a lot about what's going on at specific agencies and what was of interest for FLIOA. We want to shift gears and talk a little bit about their legislative efforts. I know, John, you guys have a bill that you're supporting that you're really excited about that's going to help federal law enforcement and in their retirement. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's something that we actually initiated and drafted, and we're working on with Congressman Reichert, who co-chairs the House Law Enforcement Caucus. The bill would, in effect, modify a provision in the Pension Protection Act of 2006, which otherwise currently allows state and local law enforcement to access what they would call their deferred comp, the equivalent of our TSP or thrift savings funds, at age 50 without getting that IRS 10% penalty. So in effect, this legislation would now include federal law enforcement, along with local and state counterparts, waiving that IRS 10% penalty if they were to access their TSP funds at age 50.
And explain for our listeners, you know, the eligibility for retirement in federal law enforcement. I think a lot of them, you know, wouldn't necessarily know if they're not in federal law enforcement, you know, that if they've got 20 years in what we call 6C law enforcement work, that they can, you know, retire, you know, at 50.
Right. Federal law enforcement, you can retire at any age with 25 years in or with 20 years in, minimum age 50. So for the most part, and you're mandatorily retired at age 57. So for the most part, we have a significant percentage of the federal law enforcement workforce retiring at age 50. And the idea being that you've worked a full career, and we have that retirement provision for a reason, which is the vigorous lifestyle and demands that takes its toll on our bodies. If we are retired, why should we not be able to access our money without a penalty, similar to our state and local counterparts?
Well, and I think the point here to make is this is the retirement, the three-prong retirement that the federal government set up for you. You know, it's when they moved you, you know, I don't think there's anybody left on CSRS in federal law enforcement. If they are, I apologize. But when they moved to FERS, you know, it came off of that traditional pension-type program like the state and locals have, that they normally would have been eligible to take their retirement immediately at age 50 or whatever, if they need 25 years. You know, they'd be able to have access to it all. But under the FERS system, as you know, it's three-pronged. It's, you know, a little bit of the pension, you know, the small pension that's available. It's Social Security. God knows if that's going to, you know, be there. And the big thing is the TSP. That's the third prong of it. And together, they're all supposed to, you know, come together and be able to provide for your retirement. So, you know, to me, it's a very persuasive argument. I mean, a position, you know, you're retiring, you're eligible to retire on this date. Why can't you have access to, you know, all of your retirement funds?
Yeah, and so and we're optimistic that this will be a piece of legislation that will be embraced by both sides, praise the Lord, and move forward quickly. Because as you said, Tony, it makes perfect sense, although that's probably a downfall for the bill, that it makes perfect sense. But otherwise, it isn't a cost to the government. We're not taking anything away. We're simply allowing people who dedicated their lives to a career in law enforcement to access their money without suffering the severe financial consequences of a 10% penalty.
Right, and the common response, you know, you get to this, and I'll play devil's advocate and say it to you. You know, the common response is, you know, why should federal law enforcement be special? Why should we treat, you know, you special with the IRS tax rules?
Because Congress decided to call us special agents, therefore we're special. Actually, I'm not. I'm just a criminal investigator. But no, the answer is that all of the provisions that are associated with the position and the occupation are built around the concept of the vigorous stressful danger aspect that a federal law enforcement or any law enforcement officer, or you know what, I'll even go broader, any public safety officer, firefighters as well, sort of endure in the course of their career. So the point being that for all of the risk and the wear and tear on your body that law enforcement brings, it makes perfect sense that we have this retirement provision, being able to retire at age 50. And it also makes sense that we can access our money because, I hate to say it, unfortunately, as the stats will show, our lifespan is less than the average person.
Well, and you need look no further than the workers' comp rolls in the federal government are predominantly littered with those who are in federal law enforcement. And to me, the argument is you are treated differently because it's your position, which is why you have the enhanced retirement benefit, which is why you're able, you know, to retire at, quote, a younger age than other federal employees. So, you know, to me, that's the argument. I wish you guys luck with it.
No, thank you.
Let's shift gears here to talk about the efforts you're doing for the federal probation and pretrial officers with their third-party arrest authority. You know, this was kind of a surprise to me, you know, when I was reading, you know, about this, because I just assumed, you know, that, you know, since they can arrest their, you know, their offenders, you know, and bring those in, that's their job. Often they have to go out and get them, that, you know, they can't protect themselves by arresting third parties.
Yeah, you know, the whole probation pretrial component has really evolved from what was seen more in the past as a sort of sociologist effort to a more law enforcement-based mission, in addition to the, I guess, the sociology piece. And by virtue of their mission, I mean, they are exposed to tremendous risk. In many instances, they're out there just one-on-one doing a visitation or an unannounced approach on an offender. Their residence or place of I call it residence. It's wherever they hang their hat is home, I suppose. But the level of danger is quite high. And they have full arrest authority under Title 18, 3606, to, as you said, Tony, to arrest an offender with or without a warrant. However, in many instances, especially when you're dealing with violent offenders, you know, be it involved in drug trafficking, violent gangs, and so forth, these folks tend to associate with others in a similar behavioral fixation. Therefore, there's a great chance that when probation or pretrial goes out, whether they're doing a conditioned search or they're by themselves, that they're going to encounter hostile third parties. And the problem is they have no legal recourse when facing a hostile, obstructive, or dangerous third party. They can't arrest them. They can't, you know, they're very limited in what they can do. They actually ultimately are forced to, quote unquote, tactically retreat. And doing that when you're inside close quarters, for example, an apartment building, sometimes, as they say, scientifically speaking, there just ain't nowhere to go. So what are you going to do? So we're trying to get a fix by having that statute amended, authorizing them to have the authority to arrest third parties who attempt to impede, obstruct, impair, or otherwise present a danger to them or anyone involved in the legal mission of probation and pretrial.
Yeah, and to, you know, to... I don't think people realize, you know, when they're coming to do their job, the probation officer, you know, I hear this saying, you know, you're judged by the company you keep. You know, so a lot of these, you know, serious, you know, offenders, violent criminals, you know, associate themselves as such with other violent criminals, gang members. And, you know, all they know is they see what they believe is a law enforcement official showing up, you know, at their residence. And you talk about, you know, being trapped in, you know, that's what they teach you, you know, in academy and things like that. You don't want to, you know, trap the bad guy in, because what's their only way out is start shooting to come at you.
Right.
But when they're in their residence, there's often no choice, you know, and, you know, they can be on drugs. They, you know, they can be, you know, inebriated in some other way, you know, and just, you know, respond in a very, very aggressive way, you know, and I'm just surprised that they haven't had the, you know, the arrest authority in the past. you know, to protect themselves.
Yeah, and the answer isn't, by the way, that, well, why don't they just sort of involve local law enforcement or other components? First of all, number one, the economy has wreaked havoc on local law enforcement, so rarely can they even give up a patrol body, if you will, to assist. The other point, Tony, as we mentioned with AUO, that second letter in the acronym, the U, uncontrollable, unexpected. These things do not happen by script. You cannot snap your fingers, Shazam, and you've got a whole, you know, law enforcement contingent there to back you up. The other added point is that when probation goes out and they have condition search teams, and when they go out and they effect a condition search, no one else is allowed on the property. That is their exclusive authority. So they're limited in the support they can even bring to any of these, you know, these incidents or these situations where they do exercise their right affecting these condition searches. So you can't eliminate the risk. You can't minimize it by making believe you've got scarecrow backup because it just doesn't exist. And here's one further crazy point. Even if you had a uniform officer there, one officer, if that officer becomes is confronted by or attacked by, let's just say, three or four bad guys, the probation officers still have no authority to help that officer. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So we're working with Senator Leahy, and hopefully we're going to get something, some language introduced to correct this critical officer safety issue.
You know, it's like in situations, you know, like that, even though they don't have, you know, authority, I'm sure, you know, a lot of these guys are going to act. It's like, you know, you want to be a zero or you want to be a hero, you know, in situations like that. And some of the statistics you guys have put together is quite telling. You know, for me, you know, of the 646 approved searches that we're talking about, you know, 408 of those, you know, we were able to seize contraband, you know, and things, you know, that were there that could, you know, that could be used against the probation officers. And what do I mean? Guns. You know, there were, you know, 71 instances of gun and ammo and all that stuff. So it's good that you're compiling statistics, and hopefully that would, you know, that would induce Congress to act.
And also, I just want to say, Tony, just to acknowledge the agency itself, the courts have been very cooperative. They fully support this as well. And it's been a good working relationship with the probation pretrial headquarters components to further this goal.
Yeah, and that's my question. I mean, how have the coordination efforts been? Because a lot of people don't realize, you know, the probation pretrial officer works for a particular court that they're in. So if they're in the Southern District of New York, they work for that court. You know, the chief judge is their ultimate boss. So you have all these different, you know, courts and different mini workplaces, you know, around the country. You know, how have your efforts been to kind of, you know, pull all that stuff together and have a collective voice?
Well, it's true. I mean, each district has a chief, and it has, and then the right. chief district judge. But the probation is also headquartered here in D.C. and has administrative oversight by an executive office, and that's who we've been working with: the director and assistant director and their staff. And they're the ones who have pulled all the districts together on this, have done a good job with it, and have provided members of Congress the requisite statistics that you reference, so they fully can appreciate and understand how important this is.
And what do you think? What do you think your success is going to be?
I always think it's going to happen because if you don't think that way, stay home and hide under the blanket. Hope for the best.
I understand. We're going to stop here and hear a word from our sponsors. When we return, we'll wrap up today's discussion with John. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then by online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We are entering our last segment of the show, and we're speaking with John Adler, the president of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, and we've been talking about some of their legislative initiatives that they have been working on this past year. John, I want to talk one about FECA, you know, which is the FECA Reform Act that I know FLIOA has been working on, you know, for several years now.
Yeah, this is a big concern for us. Unfortunately, a so-called FECA reform provision or Title III provision was in the last congressional session attached to the postal reform legislation that didn't go anywhere. This session, the same legislation was introduced, and unfortunately, the FECA piece was attached as well. So what is the FECA piece? What it attempts to do, or what it will do, is in effect remove those who are currently on disability once they reach the retirement age, and will force them out on a mandatory medical retirement. What that would do, in effect, for those currently on disability who are either getting 75% of their pay or 66 2/3 of their pay, depending on whether or not they have the dependents, it would knock them down to 50% of their pay. Our concern is this. We have heroically injured men and women who are on disability, who sacrifice their bodies to keep our country safe. They are justifiably getting their disability money. How could you now turn to someone in midstream who is injured with limited options and say, hey, guess what? Just because we think there are a couple of 90-year-olds, and this was initially put forth by Senator Collins, in effect, there are a couple of senior citizens who work for the Postal Service who are in their 90s and collecting disability because of a, as she sees it, minor injury. We should therefore take it away from everyone. And so how do you tell someone who's, you know, shot in the line of duty protecting a dignitary that now all of a sudden they're going to be placed under economic duress while their payments are lowered 15%? It's you know, again, similar to the AUO situation in D.C. This is not how this country should treat our heroically injured law enforcement officers. So we were hoping either, A, to have the FECA provision struck or removed from the postal reform bill. We lost that vote. Then there was an opportunity to make it prospective only, meaning it would only impact the next generation or the next group of hires. We didn't like that either. However, it's always good to know the rules up front. You know exactly you can budget around circumstances. But somebody who is on a certain set standard right now all of a sudden loses 15% of their pay and they've been critically wounded in the line of duty. Again, we throw heroes onto the welfare line. Is that what our country is all about?
And that's a distinction I want to make, John, because I know you're calling it disability, but in the federal employee world, it's really not disability. You know, disability is something else. You know, if you're just unable to work anymore by any kind of condition you may have, what we're talking about is injured in the line of duty. We're talking about workers' comp. We're talking about that program.
But Tony, after 45 days, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Workers' comp is 45 days and you're on disability.
But they put you on the workers' comp rolls, which you call disability. Yeah. And the point I want to make is the idea, the public policy idea behind workers' comp is employees get hurt at work. Okay, employees get hurt, particularly law enforcement officers get hurt at work. We don't want to have a culture of employees suing their employer. So we set up this what we call strict liability, disability, workers' comp system for them to go into. And, you know, and the idea is you're supposed to replicate, you know, what they could have done if they continued to work. You know, and that's where, you know, I see a lot of this bill addressing it. So the recent vote didn't go your way. What's next?
No, we lost the prospective vote, 8-7-4. So what that means now is the total or the broader postal reform bill gets voted with favor out of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. So it still has to make its way to the full Senate floor. There is no House companion bill. Fortunately, in the past session, we had a lot of allies in the House who supported our position and did not support the provisions that were then put forth by Senator Collins. We're optimistic that the House will resume their position and not buckle and support the men and women who are currently in need of sustaining that quality of life on workers' comp as they deal with serious injuries.
Okay. Well, that's good for our legislative wrap-up. And if folks want to get more information and learn what FLEO is doing for them on the legislative front, I would encourage them to go to the website at FLEOA.org. There's a wealth of information on there. You could read all the press releases as well. They're very quite active. And one organization's, I work with a lot of different organizations, and this one, is particularly gets a good reception, when they're dealing with the heads of the executive branch and the folks on Capitol Hill. I want to shift gears and talk a little bit about back to your organization and a foundation that it's associated with, the FLEOA Foundation. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the foundation and then who this year's honoree is going to be?
Sure. The FLEOA Foundation is a charitable organization, a sister organization, if you will, from FLEOA, which exists, and what its sort of mantra is that when a federal law enforcement officer or their family is in need of help, that help is only a phone call away. The foundation exists to raise money to support the families of the men and women who are killed and make the ultimate sacrifice in law enforcement, or who become terminally ill or severely injured and are, facing great financial constraints. We pride ourselves in being a first responder in terms of getting there. No bureaucracy. As soon as we find out, one of our agency representatives finds out, they brief the board, we tell the foundation, and boom. We get financial assistance there. We bring them all the information they need, the support they need to help them through a very tragic, trying crisis and difficult period of time. It's a combination of factors, whether it's counseling, whether it's unfortunately dealing with legal issues, such as the filing of the public safety officer benefit. We have our attorneys available to assist the family. But the foundation is a phenomenal organization. And another critical point of it is, unlike other charitable organizations whose mission is somewhat noble, but they sort of attribute a lot of the money they raise to pay for administrative expenses, the foundation, I think, is now down to 5 or 6% of what they raise going to pay for their operating costs. Everyone in the foundation is a volunteer. No one's getting a stipend or a salary. And again, the foundation simply exists to raise the money. Well, I should say it's not just that. I'm actually selling the foundation short. The foundation also supports the National Missing Children's Day events that our chapters host across the country. National Missing Children's Day, May 25th, which is a law. Our chapters hold these child safety events in conjunction with schools and towns and parks. And we engage members of the community, school officials, parents, to help better them protect their children. The foundation supports these events. The foundation also offers financial grants for FLEOA members' children who are applying for their first year in college.
Just to give an example to our listeners of a situation where the foundation comes in and I know has come in this case, in the tragic murder-suicide last year of the ATF agent in Virginia, murdered his wife, suicide, and there were two teenage daughters that were left, and I know FLEO was instrumental in helping there and doing other fundraising, stuff specifically for them. So that's where the money goes to stuff like that. And the other thing that you mentioned, I think, is huge for any charity, is the administrative expense. I look at that all the time. What is that overhead? What's it really going for? And almost every dollar that comes in is going out, for its intended purpose. So if folks wanted to donate to the foundation, they can get there from the website.
Yes. Similar to FLEOA, just add the word foundation. So it would be the FLEOAFoundation.org. And just one more thing, Tony. Each year, the foundation receives a support from certain Manhattan contributors to host an annual event where they recognize a law enforcement person of the year. This year, the foundation is proud to recognize the recently confirmed director of ATF, B. Todd Jones, for his outstanding work, his commitment, and staying the course through a very challenging battlefield. And we're looking forward to recognizing Director Jones for his accomplishments and for the leadership he's bringing to ATF. We're also going to acknowledge actor Vincent D'Onofrio and his wife as well, sort of the backbone, a kickstand behind the big guy, for all the great work he's done for FLIOA as well as the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial.
It's interesting to talk about the ATF director being confirmed after a long battle. You know, there hasn't been a confirmed ATF director in how many years?
Wow. Let's see. I can start counting in reverse, and I can think of at least three of them before him who were, you know, in that acting mode. But you know, again, to the director's credit, he endured a lot of congressional pettiness. There was a personnel issue from, you know, and for those of you who aren't aware, at the time that Director Jones was acting director, he was also the U.S. attorney in Minnesota as well. So he was wearing two formidable hats, and that in and of itself is commendable.
And he had to deal with the Project Gunrunner, the Fast and Furious stuff. There was a lot of hot issues that he had to come and deal with. So I'm sure it's an honor, quite deserved. John, we have a few minutes left. I know there's some other agency topics that you may want to get into.
One thing I want to say, you know, Tony, coming back to legislation, I was very proud on a personal note to introduce a legislative concept for the Congressional Badge of Bravery. Congressional Badge of Bravery, in effect, created a congressional award for all law enforcement officers that's somewhat similar to a Purple Heart. The Congressional Badge of Bravery was passed into law in 2008 and implemented thereafter. Each year, we solicit all the agency directors to nominate their men and women who have performed heroically under grave danger, especially if they were injured or unfortunately ultimately made the ultimate sacrifice. I am encouraging all law enforcement directors who may be listening, go to the website, www, if I threw too many W's in there, it's the Letters for Congressional Badge of Bravery, CBOB.gov. It's a Department of Justice website or controlled website. It'll explain to you how to go about nominating your law enforcement officers who are deserving of this important recognition.
How many of those have been awarded since the passage of the bill in 2008?
You know what? I'm proud to be the chair. There are two review boards. There's a federal review board and a state and local, and I've been sort of the first for two terms now. I would say approximately, in total on the federal level now, I'd say probably about 14 to 16 awards. It's a very distinguished award. It's not something that just sort of gets given out because we like the way someone parts their hair. This is the real deal.
So some real facts behind it. So, that's all the time we have for today. John, thanks for another great show. And thanks to all of you who joined us. Fed Talk is brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Hope everyone has a great weekend and see you next time.